Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you so much for joining me here today for another episode. This is number 440, and in just a moment, I'm so excited to share with you a conversation I had with Stephen Jenkinson, who is the grief walker from the film of the same name. He's the founder of Orphan Wisdom, the author of the book Die Wise, and he is a modern day troubadour who's been traveling around the country performing a show called A Night of Grief and Mystery that has been billed a love letter to everything that won't last. And we talk all about the show that he's been doing and dive deep into grief and why we need to be embracing it, particularly right now, and paying attention to the dark roads and the rough gods of life. I think you'll really enjoy this interview, so I'm excited to share it with you. But first, just a couple of announcements. I want to reach out and thank all of my supporters on my Patreon page at patreon.com/EOLU who've been stepping up and offering their financial support for a few years now. And I wanted to let you know there are some new bonuses for everyone who joins the Patreon community, and you can join for as little as $2 a month. I'm offering what I have been doing for a couple of years now is an end-of-life news update that comes out once a month, but now I'm also offering a little bonus recording on what to watch. That comes out at the beginning of each month and has some programming on regular television channels and streaming networks that have to do with death, dying, grief, or the afterlife. And I'm encouraging people to start watching more of this content because we've been wishing that content creators would put out more material around the end of life that is positive and informative for people. And now that it's happening, we all need to show up and watch the programming because that will ensure that they'll keep making more of it if they know there's an audience out there that cares. So in my little what to watch recordings, I'll give you some suggestions every month of things that you might watch during the month. And hopefully that'll be helpful. And I'd love it if you'd send me your suggestions because you may have stumbled across something that I haven't seen yet. So I'd like to share back and forth about that. Also on the Patreon page for our community, from time to time, I'll be sharing little bonuses from the interviews that I do, extra content that I've recorded. And hopefully I'm planning in the future to have some live Q&A chat sessions through the Patreon platform. So that will be coming up. And Patreon now makes it possible for you to follow my page, even if you're not making a donation, so you can at least see what's happening there. And if you're not sure you want to sign up and join, you can follow the page and you'll get some of the posts and you'll see what's going on at least. So that page is at Patreon, patreon.com/EOLU. And I just need to say once again that the contributions people make there are very helpful. They're helping me. They helped me get a new laptop when I desperately needed one. And I've now bought a new microphone and they're helping me defray the monthly costs of creating this podcast. And that means everything to me. Along with that, I just want to say thank you to people who've been reaching out to me and sending me emails. It means so much. I mean, literally, I'm brought to tears multiple times a day when I get special messages from people who listen and you tell me your story and what draws you to listen to these conversations and how you've benefited from them. And so this is what makes me want to be in more of a community where we actually have more opportunities to just sit down face to face and talk to each other and tell our stories together. And I'm hoping I can create that through Patreon. We'll see. That's one of my goals for this year, is to make that happen. So I wanted to take a few moments just to tell you about that and explain that to you. Those of you who are already on Patreon, you're starting already to get the What to Watch bonus episodes. And so all of this will fold out for you, and you'll be notified with each new thing that gets added to that page. So we'll move on now with my conversation with Stephen Jenkinson. And again, I'm so excited to share this with you. After, I'll be back with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy to welcome my guest, Stephen Jenkinson. And this is actually our second conversation together. Stephen teaches internationally and is the creator and principal instructor of the Orphan Wisdom School, which he co-founded with his wife, Natalie Roy. Stephen has master's degrees in theology and social work and has worked extensively with dying people and their families. He co-founded the Knights of Grief and Mystery Project with singer-songwriter Gregory Hoskins in 2015, and has toured this musical tent show revival storytelling ceremony of a show across North America, the UK, and Europe, and Australia, and New Zealand. Stephen is the author of the award-winning book Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, among other books, and the subject of the feature-length documentary film Grief Walker, a portrait of his work with dying people. His books, recordings, and DVDs are available for purchase at the Orphan Wisdom Shop on the website orphanwisdom.com. So, Stephen, welcome, and it's wonderful to have a chance to talk to you again.
Yeah, we're both still alive. That's always a good start.
Yeah. And you know, it's been 8 years. I looked back and our last conversation was 2015, which according to your bios, when you started the Knights of Grief and Mystery and Die Wise was published. So
it was a big year for me.
Yeah. It feels like a whole lifetime ago.
Indeed. Or several.
Yeah. So much so. Well, there are so many things that I want to ask you about, but right now at the top of my mind is A Night of Grief and Mystery. I know you've been on tour, you mentioned, since March, doing these amazing shows, and I would just love to hear more about them and what they consist of.
Well, first of all, it's a wonder, isn't it, that anyone would lay down hard-earned silver on the off chance that something called Nights of Grief and Mystery could be a decent alternative to Netflix. But the good thing about Nights of Grief and Mystery is it's live, and it's alive. I mean, they're both true. Years ago, I had to try to, you know, in 20 words or less kind of thing is usually how the interviews go. Nights of Grief and Mystery, 20 words or less, go. And I came up with the understanding then that what we were doing was not so much performance as it was ceremony. Now, that word carries a lot of freight, a lot of new agey kind of freight, which I'm going to try to offload immediately now and say probably not what many people would imagine with the word ceremony. What I mean by it is that we do everything we can to dismiss the notion of audience and the notion of script. It doesn't mean anything goes. It doesn't mean everybody is in with both feet and does their thing. That's not what it means. It means we're there to achieve something that's not principally cathartic. It's principally a kind of service to an exceedingly troubled time. So if we don't have audience members, what do we have? And the answer is we have allies. And that's what we try to bend everything towards and make an alliance, not with the audience, but for the sake of the life that they've put on hold to come to see us, right? So that's a big part of it. And then as far as the script idea goes, we're trying to make sure that the presence of the other world, if I can just put it in the most general way, is not crossed off the list of possibilities by us maintaining some stranglehold on the proceedings. I mean, I know where I'm going next, but I'm not sure how to get there, and I'm not sure if we arrive. And this is over the space of 2 hours, 2 hours, 10 or 15 minutes, where I'm kind of the principal voice, you would say. And somewhere in there, there's a remarkable mixture an alchemical mixture of storytelling and soothsaying and clairvoyance and deep musicality and kind of a swampy, bluesy proposition is in there. So, I mean, I'd love to see it someday.
Yeah, how amazing to get to be in the audience for that performance.
That's what people say.
It sounds, first of all, just I watched one of the videos of just you and Gregory kind of riffing off of each other. He's singing and you kind of making poetry with his lyrics, adding to his lyrics. And it was amazing and wonderful. And I wondered how can you do that night after night on this tour and show up in that way and be so spontaneous?
Vitamins. That's one, really, that is one answer. You have to keep body and soul in reasonably good working order, not showroom condition anymore, but good working order. And then you take very seriously the assignment and the responsibility. That helps a lot too. And you don't make mirth or joy the opposite of what you're doing. You make it akin to what you're doing, right? And then you realize that you're the only one that knows how this goes. So even though you could be nervous as hell in the dressing room before you get out, which typically happens, you believe, after all these years and all of these reassurances, it still happens every night. I've come to understand it's just a sign of life, you know. That's why you're just going to be nervous. And it's a sign that you know something's up, but you don't know what it is. And you're going out there to meet it in front of people, right? And I mean, I could give you a little bit of a tone for how this happens night after night. We had a piece for the longest time that we did called The Invocation, which happened off the top. I can give you a little piece of it now, and I can stop just short of making the thing happen, let's call it, in real time. So often we would begin in a form that went like this. Summoned or not, they say, the gods will be present. Maybe, I say. Sounds like bad manners. Probably going to bring bad luck, and nobody really knows. And so, welcome friends. For friends we may soon be. Friends are forged on that dark road, the one that's heading out of town. And you know it now. We're headed there. So how shall we be? And what shall we say now that the call and the summons and the plea has gone out? It's better that we make as though many a thing hangs there in the rafters above us, or hangs down here in the balance below. As if how we are with each other, that is how the lords of chance are going to be with us. As if what we say this very evening, going to bring in the saints and the ancients of days, or bring down the darkness and those rough gods. That's how we began. I mean, you can tell the stakes are considerable, right? And that we don't take things for granted, and that our attention is drawn acutely on the moment before us. And there is nothing called 2 hours from now. There's now. And then there's the next now. And that's how you do it night after night. You know, it's not really night after night. It's a sequence of nows. Yeah, so we don't go, oh, where are we? And, you know, try to make a fake alliance with the audience by naming the city early on, as you hear so often done in musical performances and things like that. Because as I said earlier, it's not a performance. We need their help to see if we can address what prompts us to do this and the distinct trouble and troubledness of the time we find ourselves in. So that's what it's a child of, I would say.
Wow. That's just so profound. And I love that you invoke the mystery of the moment and being present for each and every moment, and even present to the energy in the room and whatever people are bringing in with them and what's happening in the world at that particular moment in time as well.
And these days, you know, there's no shortage of the oh my godness of it all. None at all. In fact, tomorrow I have to have another phone call with 1,400 or 1,600 people in Israel, apropos of what's gone on the last couple, 3 weeks. And so these things, they're helpful in a heartbreaking way, that they draw a kind of bullseye, if you will, on. So I'm still alive. I've learned a few things along the way. I'm not supposed to be keeping them to myself. Now's the time. You know, the old adage, sometimes you don't ask for permission. You ask for forgiveness after the fact. If things become extreme or severe or exacting. And I think Nights of Grief and Mystery is all of those things, as well as joyful and in its way loving. But it's a kind of, you would call it rough magic, these nights. And I'm exceedingly lucky that I get to do them. And I'm more than a little mournful that, save for one more show in Toronto in the beginning of December, this whole spate of shows that were 45, I think we did this year, something like, they're finished. We just finished in Australia, a week ago last night. And then I did three nights here in Maui, finished on Sunday. So I'm a little heavily employed, you could say.
Yeah, I can understand that. And yet, oh my goodness, how rich, how amazing every single night to be able to show up with people and make an impact. And I enjoyed what was written in the email about your show is a love letter to everything that has been lost and will be lost. And, or I guess everything that won't last is a better way to say that won't last. And, that's the moment we're in when all of us are becoming aware that we just have to live on that balancing edge, cherishing everything, but knowing none of it will last.
Trying to cherish everything, failing to do so, and sometimes remembering that none of it will last. I think that's closer to the bone of how things actually are. I mean, to take one example that's kind of hanging in the air, but much in the background now. Do you remember this thing called COVID-19?
Oh, yeah.
And yet you'd never know from the daily grind that had ever really ever happened. It was a kind of near miss that has left most of us challenged at the time and glad that it's over now. Mm-hmm. And lessons learned, you know, the cautionary tales that were available to us at the time, I think by and large, they've all been thrown in the compost. And I find this tragic beyond describing. Because you just wonder, don't you just wonder, man, what's it going to take to get the continued attention of the general population long enough for things to fundamentally change?
It's so true, because I remember in the middle of COVID-19 thinking this will change everything. It must. It has to. And wondering, what will that look like? And you're exactly right. Even myself, I wander around day to day and don't think of it and forget that we've even experienced it.
Yeah, heartbreak is the order of the day, not rage. That's the way it should be. Rage is what you do when you don't know how to have a broken heart, it seems to me. So these are days of you know, outrage and the pining after condemnation. And really, I can't really believe that I was granted the education, I mean, the deep kind of education of the soul that I was lucky enough to have over the years, and a decent memory, and some gift with the language. And this is the context I'm obliged to exercise it in, this context of outrage and opinionating and condemning and destroying people's lives at a great distance, at a safe distance, and all the defamations and all the assassinations of character and all this sneering, and I could just go on. It's the whole business is so fundamentally beneath us as sentient beings, and yet in some tragic way, clearly not beneath us at all.
I know we talked a lot in our previous conversation about so-called modern medicine and its lack of soul or rejection of the idea that there is sacred, something sacred about us or the soul. But I think our whole society is suffering with that right now, from this inability to recognize sacredness and to recognize the presence of the soul.
I probably, as you might expect, see it slightly differently. I'd be inclined to suggest this. Most of us seem to be counting on a certain segregation or apartheid between sacred and everything else. And on my better days, I do everything I can to live in the presence of the fact that sacred is not an elevating designation for the extremely pretty or beautiful or numinous. Or, you know, it seems to me, as soon as we started designating certain places as sacred, it really meant the denigration of all the other places. So I'm disinclined to elevate things and times and places and people and call them sacred. I'd rather proceed like an animist does, that everything's alive, that, I mean, truly alive. I mean, possessed of a sentience and a soulfulness and deserving of exceeding regard and respect and all of that. And if that's what sacred is, amen. Unfortunately, I don't think that's what it's become during the course of my lifetime. I think it's a kind of VIP club, you know, for places and animals and nuances and phrases and things like that. I don't think we need more segregation, to be honest. I think we need a democratization of the notion of the sacred, until you'd be hard pressed to find something that isn't.
I think that's kind of how I view it, that it is all sacred in the universe. There's a sacredness to everything that exists within the universe, but that it so often just gets ignored or shoved aside. At least I see that happening in medicine all the time.
Yeah, by humans. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look to me like many other life forms are that committed to denigrating the sacred. But there's something about, let's just call it the Anglo-West, which is the only place I know anything really seriously about. And it is in our manner of being alive to elevate ourselves, even in our misanthropy. We remain an elevated species in our own estimation. And it's just lonely making at the end of the day. And the kinship that we need to have and to cultivate and to abide by with all the other life forms with which we share this situation are the first casualty of this kind of elevation of all things human, or the denigration of all things human. It's basically the same instinct, just reversed and forward gear, reverse gear, forward gear. And, just one of the things that could surely help, that you'd think could surely help, is the reminder that no matter how much you love something, no matter how great you think it is, it's not likely to last any longer than you or your regard for it. And so I've said, hundreds of times in the Nights of Grief and Mystery show, you know, I heard it said so many times when I was in the death trade that everybody knows they're going to die, which you cannot demonstrate. You can't make any proof. You can't establish any serious evidence for that claim. It sounds right, but it's not there. And so the truth of the matter is that everybody knows that everybody else is going to die. Mm. And they're the exception. And as long as we're exceptional, this place will suffer from our successes. And so would that we were much less successful at our proliferation and much more ensconced in our humanity. That would be the beginnings of a remarkable turnaround that, for example, something like COVID-19 or all the information we're allegedly on the receiving end of you know, regarding what's going on in the world, all of those things should be an opportunity to shut this momentum down and understand that we have a bit of wiggle room. Maybe, I don't know that this is true anymore, where we can still choose to do the right thing rather than have the consequences of our failure to do that forced upon us. Anyway, I guess, as they say, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Or we won't see. It'll happen and we won't see, which seems already to be so, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, I know this sounds fairly grim to anybody who was, you know, planning to dial in for like the five easy ways to get happy. Mm-hmm. But happiness isn't a goal of a serious human being. Happiness is a byproduct of living in after a certain fashion, isn't it? Surely it is. You can't be happy as a goal. I mean, you'd fail way more times than you'd succeed, which wouldn't breed more happiness, would it? Okay, so happiness is a incidental byproduct of pursuing a kind of life that affirms life rather than is constantly contrary to it. So that's what you hear me talking about. That's why it's called Nights of Grief and Mystery. That's why the book was called Die Wise. That's why I'm referred to for quite a long time as the angel of death or the death guy, all of that sort of thing. I mean, I didn't mind it, so I didn't throw it away because it was vaguely accurate, you know, but I knew it was temporary. I don't work in the death trade anymore. I haven't done so for a long time. I'd never go back. Largely because everything I hear encouraged me to believe that things are considerably worse than they were when I left.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's very true. Mm-hmm. That it's in a sense, maybe it will continue to get worse until everything falls apart and we can start over and regroup somehow in our care for dying people at the end of life.
I don't know if it's going to end of its own accord, you know. I think a calamity of like unsuspected proportions seems to be in the wings. But you'd never know it from the daily grind, would you? You'd never know that it's not working.
Yeah, that's very true. And I know I really liked what you wrote about orphan wisdom and where that term comes from and what you mean by that, which I think that's very relevant here too, as well, at least here in our Western society, that we need more wisdom in our society. We're so sadly lacking.
Yeah, we have lots of prejudice that people mistake for wisdom. We have a lot of convictions and opinions that we mistake for wisdom. We have a lot of crude, unmetabolized experiences that we imagine constitutes wisdom. But of course, none of these things, I mean, if that's what wisdom was, if it was just age plus experience, we're older as a species than we've ever been before. We live longer than we've ever done. So if what I just said is true, we'd be the wisest generation that the world has ever seen. So I don't even need to say anything more after that, except to say, would that it were so, but it's not so. So age plus experience can just add up to wear and tear, cynicism, failure to thrive, unwillingness to proceed. It can add up to those things very readily. And I think more often than not, in my corner of the world, it tends to.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that's at the foundation of so many of the issues and the problems that we're facing today.
Are we facing? This is, you know, fundamentally what I wonder now. I wonder, what does it take? How bad does it have to get? What are the signs? You know, Leonard Cohen, bless his bones, said 1,000 things that are important, seems to me. And one of them is, we asked for signs. The signs were sent. We're living with them on every street corner. And someday, I mean, years and years or decades or centuries from now, what will this time look like to people with any ability to reassemble it and hold together enough for them to be able to see how we conducted ourselves, given what we claim to know? I mean, what will we look like? What will we sound like? What will all our gestures, all our activities, all our leisure pursuits, all our personal development pursuits, what will they look like to them? That is not a bad thing to submit yourself to. Not what does this look like to you? What will it conceivably look like to people? We're not even conceived as we speak today, but we'll be conceived in a time, a kind of storm that we were not conceived in, but eventually live to see. And I'm afraid the reactions are likely to be damning as much as anything else. So if you'd rather not be damned in the time to come, which wouldn't be a good idea, but if you'd rather not be damned, then proceed accordingly now. I've never said that out loud, but hearing it now, sitting in this little room in Maui, in Hawaii, it sounds as true as anything I've ever been granted to see.
We don't have time to waste.
I'm not sure we have time at all. I mean, things are beyond urgent, no? They just, just are. It doesn't matter if somebody listening to this doesn't agree. Their disagreement is irrelevant. That sounds intolerant. It is intolerant. The times that we're in do not lend us the cushion of room to decide. We're already in the time where things are being decided instead of us, beyond us, not with recourse to us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know, Stephen, in your notes that you wrote about starting back in 2015, this project, Nights of Grief and Mystery, you wrote that you wondered back then, would anyone show up to an event that had grief in the title? And it sounds like it's been proven that yes, they will. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about that.
Okay. What would you like to hear about it?
Just your thoughts about what responses are you, do you feel people are drawn to these events because grief is in the title? Do you feel like, in fact, people are expressing a need to deal with grief?
Well, in no particular order, just as they occur to me, one answer would be people are coming because they've heard of me in some other context, from some other source or some other word of mouth thing or something. So that contributes quite a bit. And then secondly, a good number of people are not there of their own free will. This is true. I canvass people from the stage and afterwards in the book signing lineups. And I can tell you a decent percentage of these people are here because somebody brought them or cajoled them or threatened them in some fashion, you know, that they had to come kind of thing. So I've had numerous people say to me, you know, I had no idea what to expect when I came. And now that I've seen it, I don't know what it was. So enough people say that, there's a degree of curiosity, isn't there, that begins to rise up around the thing? And Nights of Grief and Mystery partakes of a kind of art form that's so old that no living person has any kind of a memory of such a thing. But occasionally, like an old world person will see it and they say, this is like from my great great grandparents' time. That's the distinct feeling of it, that it's of another time. It's old that way. It has a kind of older memory, you know. What else brings them? Yeah, for sure. What you've imagined, that the word grief in the title is a kind of homing device or a kind of weather vane. You know, but just as many as not come to their Tuesday nights or their Saturday nights as a place to be as grief-free as they can manage. So, and yet they somehow find themselves there. And I'm glad they do. And, you know, there's an overlap with why I'm there, which is, listen, I've seen more of life than I'm going to see. Okay. And what you're seeing in front of you in real time is what a guy's doing with what's left to him. And there's a kind of high wire act about that, that people want to see, want to witness, I think. And yeah, there's curiosity, and there's a sense that all is not as it should be. And maybe very occasionally their entertainment dollar should go in that direction. Hmm. Not in the direction of McDonald's and a popcorn night, you know. So I'm glad they come.
And you alluded to something that I read that you wrote about as being in the second half of life and how things change. And I'm in the second half of my life as well, and reflect on that a lot, of how the focus shifts, and it's actually very nice. I like it a lot that the focus is more inward and has more depth and more richness, even as the days available get shorter and shorter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were always getting shorter when you were younger too, right? But it didn't register in the fashion that it may now. My own understanding of these first half, second half, third half. The third half of life is very short. It's basically how it ends, right? The first half of life is youth, including the blindsidedness of youth. And then the second half is the strange, yet to be written story of what did you do with the first half? How is it still there? Is it still there? Was there any learning that evolved from it? Or is it possible, which is what I'm going for, that the second half of your life is to take the reasons for your birth, the reasons for the fact that you're still alive and not dead yet, and you plant them somewhere. You don't walk around with them like spare change. You actually plant them, invest them in a particulars of a time and a place and people to do it with. And so my own take on it is that it's not an inward journey, the second half of your life. It's actually taking the fruits such as they were of the inward journey of your self-absorption in your younger years. And you find a place where that could possibly have some value or some use, which is a community or a village-minded thought about the second half, not a personal development thought about the second half. So I tend to favor that orientation, which probably explains why, you know, I tour since March, when I could have been home watching the flowers grow.
Yeah. Do you feel maybe pulled toward it, or that feels like a priority?
I feel that. I feel rewarded by the ability to do it. I feel that the good fortune I've had to be relatively healthy and capable is not to be taken for granted, or I don't grant to myself an unlimited amount of that. And so I have a sense of urgency about proceeding, you know, and I'm probably a somewhat less careful than I might have been earlier on. The notion of self-preservation is not so strong. I mean, I feel responsible to, you know, like the vitamins joke I made earlier, I certainly do all that, but it's not so that I can just keep going at all costs. It's that I can deliver on what I think the second half of my life is asking of me.
I know in the invocation that you spoke to us, I loved the term, the dark roads that are awaiting each one of us. And I know that's actually also the title of one of the albums that you and Gregory made. Is that correct? But would you talk to us a little bit about the dark roads?
Yeah. Yeah, the name of the two records we came up with during the pandemic were Rough Gods and Dark Roads. Yeah. Well, You may be aware of the fires that happened on this island about 2.5 or 3 months ago.
Yes.
Right. So that's the context for being here. And the lion's share of the first night here, which would have been just Friday past, I was talking at great length about crisis. And I began and probably ended with the same thing, that it was an etymological observation about the word. And it doesn't mean the way it's used today. It doesn't mean anything close to it. It literally means place where the paths intersect somehow. So you can hear crisis and cross, Christ and cross, virtually the same word. Yeah. So that's what it means. It means there was a time when certain possibilities were traveling in parallel lines. They weren't bumping into each other. And so to a certain extent, though you had many choices you could make, you didn't really have to make any because there was no impact between them. So you could kind of nurse them along as separate ideas in your own little life, or understanding things in a much broader sense, you know, as to how the world works, parallel lines. And then certain things happen or stop happening. And these things begin to overlap. They cross, right? They don't collide in the sense in like this. They simply overlap. And what that means is all the possibilities that you were nurtured by, most of them don't exist anymore. There's a few possibilities. There's a few choices to be made. And you must make one. So it doesn't matter if you're not ready. It's a shame you're not ready because you had opportunity to ready yourself, but you didn't. Now it's too late for being ready, but you're going to decide anyway. And you are deciding. Boom. That's what a crisis is. You are deciding. It doesn't matter whether you recognize that you're doing that or not. You are. So that's why, you know, the blues songs that you've heard over and over again, they refer to, I went down to the crossroads, got down on my knees, that sort of thing. Made the deal with the dark forces, that sort of thing. Got my treasure there, you know, got my mojo there. All of that stuff comes from this understanding that crises belong in a deeply lived life. They're not the undoing of that life or that living. They are one of the occasions for doubling down on what it means to still be around. And I think that's what Nights of Grief and Mystery fundamentally is a willingness to proceed as if it's, as they say, situation critical.
Wow, that is so powerful. Understanding this, the crossroads that occur during a crisis, because I think many people, a crisis occurs and it appears to be just a disruption on the straight path they're on. And it's temporary and they'll get past it and continue on the same path. But it's so profound that no, this is a crossroad and it's not the same path anymore. Now you don't have a choice. Now you just have to keep going and you have to make what you can of what's left.
I wouldn't say that you don't have a choice. I would say that compared to the wide openness of former days, it would seem that you don't have a choice. And this might seduce you towards some kind of collapse or paralysis or impotence. But in actual fact, the meaning of a crisis is that the choices are few, but they're still there. Two, that you must decide now. Three, that you are deciding. See, that's it's not blinking on you. It's not going to secretly go behind your back and give you what you really want to keep you going for a while longer. That's not what a crisis is. It's not inconvenience. It's many things are not as they were and they're not coming back. Are you able to proceed in the presence of that finality? You must, as a grown-up, you must be able to do that. So that's the throwdown of a crisis, you see, and this is why it has the reputation of being deeply inconvenient, ill-timed, poorly chosen, not deserved, but none of those things are real. The presence of a crisis is all the evidence you need that its time has come.
And that fully resonates with me when I look back at my own grief experience after many years ago, my father died by suicide, which was that crisis, that crossroad in my life. And the reason I got stuck for a while is because I didn't want to change. I didn't want to let this experience change me or push me in a different direction. And I resisted it. And what you're saying is, I think that's what makes us crazy in some ways. If we resist it, it's when we recognize what the crisis is and understand now we have to allow ourselves to be changed and let go of whatever doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. You could say it that way. You could say you have to work very hard at not being yourself anymore. Hmm. Yourself being understood as something historical whose time has already come and gone, because the circumstances are asking other things of you other than your old habits of self-understanding. Yeah. So this is why it feels so contentious, because you wouldn't choose to end the utility of your habits. Nobody does. That's the nature of habit, after all, is that it seems to work indefinitely, even addictions of all kinds. The reason they persist is because they work. They do other things too, but they surely work. That's what's so compelling about them, right? And so we have to find a way to acknowledge that life is not interested in our habits. It's not fighting them either. It's just proceeding otherwise. You're a stone and life is a river. And it will go around you if you don't learn that the flow is not your enemy. It's not your friend, but it's not your enemy either. It's something closer to companion. Yeah, it's there. And sometimes you float, sometimes you swim, but it's rare that you will ever push the river and win.
It's such profound wisdom for this time that we're in right now, when there's crisis everywhere around the world, and I'm sure even everywhere you've been performing, you're aware of it and you sense it and feel it.
Did you see the email, the newsletter came out yesterday?
No.
Oh yeah, have a look. It's called Sky Vow. Hmm. Sounds vaguely biblical. It kind of was. We're driving in from the Brisbane airport. I think it was Brisbane or maybe Adelaide. It's hard for me to remember now. And it was the darkest sky. We thought we ducked a storm. It was a little rough, you know, landing. We got our stuff, rented the truck, and da da da. Finally, we're driving. We're out of the airport. We're in kind of that god-awful no man's land that tends to be around all urban airports. And somebody looked out the window to our left, and against a black sky virtually was a double rainbow.
Oh, wow.
Which was prior to us going to the sound check and getting ready to do the show. And, you know, there's an old spiritual song, probably an old church song. I don't know the name of it, but "Oh Mary, don't you weep no more" tends to be the chorus. You may have heard it. And there's a verse in there that says, God gave Moses a rainbow sign, no more water, but fire next time. Hmm. Which when you hear it, doesn't sound all that chippy, does it? It doesn't sound all that good newsy, which you imagine spirituals are designed to do. They're not. They're designed to read you the news. So the last line in the newsletter is something like, maybe we're in between. The rainbow sign, what does it mean? No more water. I mean, no more floods, but fire next time. And of course, look where I am here, where fire for about, about an hour or whatever, how long it took to do what it did, was a fact of life, a devastating fact of life. And the devastation deepens since then, from everything I've heard and seen since I've been here. And this is obviously true in Israel as well, and in the Gaza. And you know, we've already stopped talking about Ukraine. But of course, nothing's different there. And they're off the front page, which is their nightmare come true, that the West would start to get tired of Ukraine and just simply look elsewhere for its distractions and its heartbreak. So man, I mean, it's wild days.
Yeah. In the midst of all of this, Stephen, do you find hope, or where and how do you find hope?
I don't. Nor do I lament the fact that I don't. Now, I wouldn't say I go looking for it, But I'm on record now, and especially in the Daiwai's book, as taking hope to task and saying it doesn't belong in a time such as ours, generally because of what it asks of people. So very briefly, as I understand what hope does to people, it works something like this. You don't hope for the way it is. You hope for the way it isn't. Your hope is not based in now. Your hope is contrary to now, probably hostile to now. You want something that's not here yet. That's what being hopeful is all about. See, my conviction, for myself at least, is to be here now. And hope makes that all but impossible. So if you're asking me something closer to how do I proceed given the sorrow and all that sort of thing, the answer is proceeding and being heartbroken are not opposites. You can proceed heartbrokenly. Okay. But I wouldn't say at the same time that you would go looking for that as some kind of secret enabler. That you don't have to go looking for heartbreak. You just sit tight for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. And you know that heartbreak will find you. Not of the personal romantic kind. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the willingness to see. You know, I read a book that not that long ago, and there was a two-line entry in the book. And it said, the resident hermit of such and such a cathedral in New York City. Who knew there was such a thing? Mm. And immediately I'm zeroing in like, man, what's coming after this? The resident hermit of the such and such cathedral in New York City, when she finally emerged to say something after God knows how many years of utter silence and no human contact, she said, it's like she'd just been reading the paper the day before. She said, the thing is, now we have to face the way it is. I know it doesn't sound like, it sounds like a fortune cookie. But imagine that after years of withdrawal from the mayhem and the front pages, that's what you come down from the mountain with. We have to face the way it is. So that to me is what devotion sounds like. And that's what you get to do if you're not hopeful. You get to face the way it is, not all the time, not sucking on the fire hose of information. That's not what I mean. But I mean that you're not a stranger to your times. That in case any young, you know, person at one-third your age is looking and wondering, what does it look like to take seriously the time that you're in? They don't for the moment have to look further than you. That's the job.
That's the dark road.
That's the dark road.
Yeah. And then the rough gods. I'm not sure what role the rough gods play.
Well, I don't think they play a role. They have a presence, you see. Mm-hmm. They're not sort of side men to the show. They are as much the show as there is. But depending on the story that you walk around with, you could imagine the advent of troubled times is some kind of punishment scenario. I mean, I think most people do walk around with that understanding. And they don't think they're believers in Old Testament fatalism. But, you know, so many people who in the world who look like me are. Doesn't matter that they don't believe in the Bible. Clearly, the Bible believes in them. And so they walk around with the notion that, you know, we're going to pay for what we've done and that sort of thing. And it's not sin and trespass. It's consequence. It's a different tone completely. And the rough gods are the presence of consequence, particularly the consequence of the things that you did not intend. That's the big one. Do you know that's the etymology of the word awake?
I didn't know that.
Of the wake. The wake, yeah? The thing that ebbs out behind you as you proceed. So the quality of being awake is the quality of being gathered into an understanding that most of the consequences that emanate from you are accidental, incidental, and unintentional. And so we tend to not feel responsible for those because I didn't do it, because I didn't mean to do it, because I wasn't alive at the time, because, you know, my ancestors 3 generations ago did it. So how can I possibly be guilty? Nobody's saying you're guilty. But if you're asking me, I'm saying you're living off the avails of what they did. And so it's time to get it straight. Or as I like to say, this phrase came to me the other, you know, anybody can do the math if they're so inclined and they have a decent heart and a good eye. But man, some of us have to do the aftermath. And this is aftermath time, isn't it? This is time of consequence. This is the rough gods have come round and they're on Main Street now. And they're not punishing. They're showing.
And we just can no longer deny that there are consequences.
Yeah, we can. You know we can. Of course, there's no bottom to denial. So it's important that, you know, you watch when you say things like, we can't do this anymore. It's just a lie. Of course we can. What you mean, of course, is we ought not to. But we're fully capable of proceeding exactly this way as far into the future as anybody can imagine. You know that's true. That's why you called me in the first place here to do this. Because you know, man, nothing automatically changes anything. Nobody automatically changes because things get weird. Because the water starts to rise. Nobody does. I shouldn't say nobody. That's probably unnecessarily extreme. But the critical mass of people that could make some fundamental difference are waiting to be persuaded even now.
But then, Stephen, talk to me as we're closing out here about the mystery then. What about the mystery, and how do we recognize the mystery and allow for the presence of mystery?
Well, first of all, to allow for the presence of mystery suggests that you're somehow the boss or in charge. And it's the nature of mystery to remind you, oh, no, you're not. You're a bit player in your own little life, right? So mystery, first of all, is not a gap in your understanding. It's not a hole in your knowledge. Mystery, once deeply apprehended and respected, is the rest of your knowledge instead. It's not more of the same. It's all the stuff you couldn't have thought of, the stuff that doesn't make any sense to you, the stuff that you can't automatically find corroborating meaning in. Mystery is, that's the part just beyond the horizon that you don't really ever get to visit, because when you advance towards it, the horizon recedes from you. See, to maintain its mystery. It's not unkind to you. It's just not human. And it doesn't have any interest in imitating us. Since us being us is not working out so great. So mystery imitating us would kind of be cruel. So it seems mystery is very much like wilderness. Maybe that's a good analogy. Wilderness suffers when we go in our Gore-Tex to find it. And if it's smart at all, which I suspect it is, it recedes as we pursue it. So then you realize the pursuit of mystery by leaving your home place is a mistake. So you realize it's the courting of mystery by staying home that I'm talking about now. The strange magic of being willing to stay home, which I'm obviously lousy at since I'm touring around doing what I'm doing. So, I mean, you could say, don't listen to that guy. He contradicts himself all the time. Not all the time, but where necessary, yeah, I do. I can't live all the solutions, not and make the case and make the plea and make the prayers at the same time. I can't stay home and say, summoned or not, they say the gods will be present. Maybe, I say. Who am I saying that to? After I say it once at home. So for a time, you know, we have the grace that somehow sustains us in going from place to place, wondering about rough gods and dark roads and grief and mystery and love letters to what won't last. Yeah, and they all belong in the same evening. And look how much we got into an hour.
Yeah, in the same evening, in the midst of a crisis.
Yeah, because of a crisis, in the name of a crisis, not to provide an alternative to the crisis, but to proceed faithful to the crisis. And I think that's what makes you an elder, to be honest, is your willingness to proceed in good faith, given the troubles of your times. So you're diminished by the faith that you're willing to exercise about the troubles of the times. It actually diminishes you. But it's like wine, you know, when you finally cross the finish line of wine, you don't have the 500 gallons you started with. To have that depth of flavor and consequence and alchemy and so on, that magic, there's less of you as a barrel of wine. There's less than the 500 gallons you started with. But it's all wine now. And that's what an elder is, you know, deepened by diminishment. And you can tell that's what I'm advocating.
Wow. Wow. That's profound. And it's deeply inspiring, as you said, without resorting to hope, but as a reason to be here. And
a way of being here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I hope I get the chance. I hope you'll do another tour next year of Nights of Grief and Mystery. Probably too soon to ask you that.
No, it's not too soon. We've had a lot of requests for places we didn't go to this year. And, you know, without being arrogant on the matter of being able to continue, if we have our way, we're going to finish a record in the first half of this year that we've started, a new record, whose focus is love. Yeah. Because Nights of Grief and Mystery is an act of love, for sure. So we're bringing that to the forefront of the proceedings. And if we make a new record, obviously the tour is going to be principally animated by the new record. So we'd have to learn how to do all that and translate all that into new material, new songs, and a new sense of the presence of the whole thing and recraft it. And it's not a bad assignment to have. So the second half of the year, perhaps in September, October, will, if we're successful and we don't embarrass ourselves, then the likelihood is that we're going to mean to be out there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the world needs you. So I'd love to see you grace us all with another tour. And I would hope that I might get to attend one of your nights.
Amen. Well, where are you?
Right now I'm in California. Half the year I'm in Colorado. So,
Well, we've played a number of shows in both places. So, you know,
I've missed my chance so far, but.
Well, you know, you're very kind to say that thing about the world needs me. I don't know that as an experience I myself have, but God knows I need the world, and that's enough for me to proceed on.
Mm. That's very well said, Stephen. Well, thank you so much for giving me your time. I know I'm sure you're tired. I'm sure you're very busy, and I really appreciate having an hour to just sit and talk with you. Thank you.
You're very kind. And, you know, your questions are the reasons. They really are. The things to wonder about are more important than the answers by far. So thank you for the reminder.
You're very welcome. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Stephen Jenkinson. You may want to go back and listen to it again. I've listened to it two times after we held the conversation, and each time I'm still blown away by some of the wisdom that Stephen is sharing that almost goes over my head as I'm trying to grasp it all as he's speaking. I spoke with Stephen in 2015. I interviewed him about the book Die Wise for one of my Death Expo events that I used to hold back then. And similarly, we had an amazing conversation, but it's so fascinating how much has changed for Stephen during that time, being on the road and taking his Nights of Grief and Mystery around the world to touch other people. I'm profoundly touched by all of it. As I said before, go back and listen to it again. And a few days from now, the video of our conversation will be posted on YouTube if you want to see Stephen on the video. So you can go to the YouTube channel, also called End of Life University, although it'll take a few days for that to be prepared. So, gosh, if you enjoy content like this, please be sure and tell other people about it. When you share these episodes with other people, it really helps the numbers of downloads that I get and also helps us go up in the rankings. But also if you subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen, that's very helpful as well, so that people who are searching for this kind of content are able to find it more easily. And I'm really trying to grow the community here of people who are looking for death positive options at the end of life and who are comfortable just talking about life and death and all that that entails. So thanks again for being here and joining me and listening in. And don't forget to go to patreon.com/EOLU if you want to join our community there. And until we're together next week, when I'll be back with another interview, remember that we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life may bring you, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.